Good evening and welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Kathy Wilkerson. Wilkerson was active in the Civil Rights Movement, Students for a Democratic Society, and the Weathermen. In March of 1970, she was one of two women to survive an explosion in the basement of her father's townhouse that killed three weathermen who were building bombs for the cause. Wilkerson spent 10 years underground before surrendering in 1980. She was sentenced for possession of illegal explosives and spent a year in jail. For the last 20 years, she has worked as a mathematics educator in New York City schools. She recently published a very powerful memoir about her political years called Flying Close to the Sun, My Life and Times as a Weatherman, published by Seven Stories Press. I'm speaking to Kathy Wilkerson by phone from her home in New York. Hi, Kathy Wilkerson. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Now, you were born at the end of World War II and were brought up a middle-class girl in Connecticut. What was it that initially attracted you to political activism?
Well, I think I went to public school in the early 50s, and we said the Pledge of Allegiance every morning in the Lord's Prayer because it was before the Supreme Court decision, and we sang three patriotic World War II movies, songs every day. And what I took from that was liberty and justice for all, and that you should fight for what you believe in. And I just applied that as I grew older to everything that I saw in the world.
Mm-hmm. And you saw a lot of injustice, indeed.
Well, yes, first of all, nuclear weapons were terrifying to all of us because we had to do those nuclear weapon drills. And then I began very early to see that people were treated differently, that there was not indeed a level playing field in this country, and there was not indeed equal opportunity. So by the time I was in high school, I was really actively looking for some sort of explanation for this. And I happened to have been lucky to have been born during the Civil Rights Movement and began to hear stories about the sit-ins in the South.
Mm-hmm. Now, you joined Students for a Democratic Society, known as SDS, in the early 60s when you were a student at Swarthmore. Now, what was SDS doing that actually attracted you at the time?
Well, again, it was really the Civil Rights Movement. That when I was a freshman in college, one of the seniors had been working in the South during the summers and had more recently worked in Cambridge, Maryland, which was fairly near us. And he organized a trip of other students to go down on the weekends to support their efforts to integrate employment in the downtown stores in Cambridge, Maryland. And so I traveled down with him and other students to Cambridge, Maryland, and was introduced to the Civil Rights Movement and met the movement in Cambridge was led by a young black woman named Gloria Richardson, who had the meetings at her house, even though the house she was threatened with firebombing for doing that. And she was warm, she was articulate, she was courageous, and I saw somebody that I wanted to be like. I said, this is somebody I want to grow up to be. Mm-hmm. And I thought that it was outrageous that the stores in downtown Cambridge, Maryland wouldn't hire black people. And I was really proud to be part of a movement to fight against that.
Mm-hmm. And the movement was also in the business of stopping the Vietnam War at that time as well, right?
Well, this was 1962 and 63. Mm. So the war was just beginning to be on our horizon. And I was not, I was not raised in a political family. My parents were Republicans, but not active in politics. And I didn't know really that much about the war in Vietnam but at that point. The students on campus who were active mostly in the Civil Rights Movement, and because later they organized in Chester, Pennsylvania. My sophomore year, we were involved in a school integration fight there, and I went in every day, pretty much. But it was during my sophomore year, really, that we were sitting around the cafeteria at campus late at night where people gathered to talk politics rather frequently, and somebody said, well, gee, I don't understand this war in Cyprus. It doesn't make any sense to me. And I said, yeah, I feel the same way about the war in Vietnam. And he leapt out of his chair and he said, no, Vietnam is different. Vietnam is an anti-colonial independence struggle. And he then proceeded to explain to me what the history of Vietnam had been and why it was a very important and critical struggle and represented many other fights around the world for independence for small countries who were at that time already rebelling against the World Trade Organization and the World Bank, and this sort of attempt by the United States to force third world countries to structure their economies in a way that exported wealth to this country and prevented them from developing local industry.
Mm-hmm. Now, in those early days, did you believe that education was the most reasonable way to change policy and win people to your causes?
Certainly, because mm-hmm. that was how I was brought into the movement and won over, was by my fellow students, and it was mostly my peer group, not rarely professors, teaching me about civil rights, about what it was going on in the South, teaching me about the war in Vietnam, about the World War II and the economic history of the United States. All of that was really, the more I learned, the more active I became. So I assumed, like we all did, that it was an information problem, that the American people didn't have the right information. And if we could get people involved in politics, in the public taking responsibility for the national welfare, they would educate themselves and would see what was going on in the world and become more active participants in it. And we called it participatory democracy.
And very early, you got disillusioned by electoral politics as well.
Well, not during college. In college, during that period of time, there were a number of people who ran as peace candidates against the war. So it seemed like possibly Congress could be a place that could lead change. It seemed to me like that. And to many people in SDS, there were a great number of people in early SDS who thought our purpose really was to influence politics in the Democratic Party. And so when I graduated from college, I was very lucky to get a job working for one of the first congressmen to vote against war appropriations in Vietnam, which was as controversial then as it was to vote against appropriations in Iraq now.
Mm-hmm. And who was that congressman?
Congressman Robert Kastenmeier from Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so I did go to work for him, and I was shocked to find out that although he had a very progressive voting record, when he was in his home district in Wisconsin, he never talked about the war because he was afraid that people would accuse him of being unpatriotic, would smear him with being a communist because it was still the echoes of the McCarthy era were reverberating. But it wasn't unlike now people being afraid of being soft on terrorism.
And so
he would not discuss or try to organize people to understand what was happening in Vietnam. And it was then that I realized that because congressmen are elected so frequently, and because they're vulnerable to these tiny minorities in their districts mounting these kind of smear campaigns where they accuse them of doing and believing all kinds of things they didn't actually do or believe, but it gets out on the airwaves, these accusations, that Congress can't lead a big change like this. Congress has to follow what the American people demand that they do.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's talk about SDS and how it eventually evolved into the Weathermen. Well, what were the issues that helped create this offshoot?
Well, SDS was going strong as a advocate for participatory democracy up to and deep into 1968. But 1968 was really a turning point because King was killed, Robert Kennedy was killed, and the Black Panther Party, which was sort of the northern continuation of the civil rights movement, had become very popular among young black urban students and young people, and had come under this kind of ferocious attack by northern police departments, very similar to the kind of attacks by the Klan that the civil rights movement had to endure early on.
Mm.
And King, when he was killed, was trying to move from the political goal of ending Jim Crow laws, which the civil rights movement had successfully accomplished by forcing the federal government to come into the South, to raising issues around economic equality. And the Panthers also had an economic program. And it was when the movement began to take on the issue of economic equality that we began to flounder, because, first of all, it's a much more complex issue than simple equality, equal access to public accommodations and to the vote. Although that was a huge fight that had been going on for 100 years, we had won it. But the economic issues were much more complicated, and we were much less prepared to fight the battles. And then when the FBI in 68 and 69 began to systematically attack leadership of the movement, including pacifists, draft resistors, but most viciously against the black movement.
Mm-hmm.
Many of whom were killed. And we found out only much later, after Watergate, that indeed every single FBI office was required to submit a plan to J. Edgar Hoover showing how they were dismantling the leadership of dissent in their areas. And to quote the FBI, they wanted to, quote, prevent the rise of a black messiah at any cost. And at any cost seemed to be pretty broadly drawn. So we didn't know that it was actually in writing, but we were experiencing the fact that dissent was under tremendous attack, and that black people were under particular attack. And it was incredibly upsetting.
Then
in December 1969, Fred Hampton, the leader of the Black Panther Party in Chicago, whose office was just a few blocks from the National SDS office, was assassinated in his bed by the Chicago police.
Yeah.
And that was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back. And we said, look, is this 1938 in Germany? Is this like Kristallnacht? Are we pretending that the government is about to absolutely eradicate all the leadership of dissent like Hitler did in Germany? Should we prepare? Should we build a resistance and develop the capacity to defend ourselves and to operate away from the eyes of the government?
So you decided to create the Weathermen.
Well, Weatherman had started sort of as in its early chaotic days, its strategy was sort of, if you're going to do these things, we're going to create chaos in response.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, that was chaos is the weapon of the weak.
And exactly.
It's the weapon of a 2-year-old and a 3-year-old.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it was not a well thought out strategy and only brought the police more heavily down on us. So once Fred was killed, then people really began to think about forming a clandestine movement. And it was only a little over 2 months after that the townhouse happened.
To talk to us about the townhouse.
Well, by the townhouse, I mean the explosion in which there were 5 people, all members of Weathermen, in the house, some of whom at that moment were building pipe bombs. And that group of people of whom I was a part sort of were the culmination of Weathermen's transition, which was to say, if the government is going to go after dissent, we are going to exact a price. But by that point, we had decided that we had to be more precise than just creating chaos, like we did in the Days of Rage, the really nutty demonstration in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And we said, we're going to go after the United States Army, which is the symbol of United States violence all over the world and in this country.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so the pipe bomb was destined for Fort Dix, which was an army base outside of New York and New Jersey. So something went wrong in the building of it, and two people were killed instantly and a third almost instantly, and two of us survived the blast. And what happened is when the pipe bomb went off by mistake, it set off a box of dynamite that was next to it on the work table, apparently, and it was that box of dynamite that brought the whole house down.
Mm-hmm. And after this, you ended up going underground for several years. Can you talk to us about what you were doing during that time?
Well, after the townhouse explosion, I knew that were I to stick around, I would be questioned by police and it would be violent. Because at that point, the police interrogations had gotten very violent. They had tortured several Black Panther members in New Orleans when they had been arrested. And the torture was videotaped and is now the subject of a case going on in San Francisco where they have rearrested eight Black Panthers and charged them with murder for a case stemming from way back then. And some of these Panthers are the ones who were tortured, and so that video evidence is now part of that case. And one of the weathermen had been arrested and hung out a window, a third floor window, by his toes and sort of slammed against the side of the building. So we knew by then, and several of them had been beaten up by the police and so on. So I knew that after they figured out that it was a dynamite explosion, if I was interrogated by the police, it would be an exceedingly unpleasant experience. So I went underground, and most weathermen who, as soon as they heard about it, did the same thing, because any weatherman would have been subject to this kind of interrogation. And Weatherman as an organization lasted essentially until the war in Vietnam ended, because it was the war that really held us together. And by the time the war in Vietnam ended, the Panthers had really been decimated and destroyed. So the fight to support them was of less urgency. And then the war was over. So the internal disagreements within Weathermen, which were enormous, but had been suppressed by our mutual desire to fight against the war, then took over, and Weathermen fell apart very rapidly within a year of the end of the war. But I was facing very serious charges, the most serious charges of anyone in Weathermen, and so I chose to stay underground for another 4 or 5 years.
And you finally surfaced and turned yourself in 1980. Well, what made you decide to do that at that point?
Well, at that point, Jimmy Carter was president. There was an era of Watergate had happened. It had become clear that the FBI could not prosecute Weatherman because they had done so many illegal things in pursuing us and in investigating the left in general. And they didn't want to go into court and have any more of those things exposed than had already been exposed. And still, to this day, we don't know the half of it because they have made it exceedingly difficult to get records. But because it was post-60s and post-Watergate, there was an atmosphere under Jimmy Carter of reconciliation. And so draft resistors who had gone to Canada were pardoned. And it seemed like a moment when I could turn myself in and my particular case could be dealt with somewhat rationally and routinely rather than with an atmosphere of hysteria. And that is indeed what happened.
And you spent about a year in jail for possession of illegal explosives, correct?
Yes.
How were you treated in jail?
Well, I was at Bedford Hills, which is was at the time the only maximum security prison for women in New York. And I was in prison with lots of women who were mostly in for charges related to drugs or domestic violence. And so women in the prison were fascinating. They were interesting. They were thoughtful women. There was all kinds of interesting conversations. And I found it to be a wonderful place to be were I not concerned about other issues on the outside.
Now,
jail itself is idiotic because you you have to spend a third of your day standing in line and not talking or doing jobs that somebody else has just done. So you're treated like an infant given make work to do. And it dulls the mind and kills the spirit if you don't have an education and an ability to rise above that.
Yeah, well, there's been much discussion about how prison is not really meant to rehabilitate. That's kind of a joke. Now, after leaving prison, you ended up getting a master's in math and have been teaching ever since?
Well, I actually went to school in engineering first to be a technician, and worked as a technician for a couple of years in New York, and then I worked on the Attica case for several years. My attorney also happened to be the attorney who represented the prisoners who had been killed in the Attica massacre when the New York State went into the prison and killed 40 people. So I worked on that case for a year, but I had been recruited to teach classes at night to women who wanted to go into technological careers but needed to pass a math test to do it. And that was how I began to teach math and got drawn in. And I didn't actually go to school to get a master's in math education until 10 years later.
Oh. Now, in retrospect, do you believe that the Weatherman Organization did anything positive to affect the changes that you were so passionate about?
Well, I think by 1969 and 1970, no one knew what to do. The anti-war movement didn't seem to be working. There was this hideous backlash against school integration in the northern cities. In New York City, school buses carrying black kindergartners were stoned. And then there was this attack on the Black Panther Party. So everyone was kind of desperate and didn't know what to do. So Weatherman was not different in that respect. And various people made various choices, all of which were hard and difficult because didn't speak to sort of the enormity of what was going on. Weatherman, I think, effectively expressed a very, very widespread felt outrage at what was happening. While people didn't agree with what we did, because most of it didn't make any sense, they were happy that somebody was giving voice to this outrage from the heart, from the gut, at the rampant violence practiced by the government and by small minority sectors of the American society. So it was a very confusing situation, and I think in retrospect, I did the best that I could do with the information I had at the time. I believe that that voice of outrage needed to be expressed. I think our choice of tactics of using armed devices that are at the center of what the government's doing wrong was unfortunate. I think our desire to disrupt and confront was correct in the face of what was happening around us and napalm babies on the TV every night. But I think we needed to be more rigorous, more creative, and really forge new ground in our attempt to express that rage.
You were very honest in your book about how you continuously grappled with the constant question about violence and or education, and your book was quite effective. Your discomfort came through loud and clear.
Well, I think I wrote the book because I think this issue of violence is so critical now. I mean, the world is just saturated with violence. And most of the attempts to fight violence with violence failed. But in 1969, it looked like a great many of them were going to succeed. I mean, there were national liberation struggles in Africa that looked very hopeful in Angola, in Guinea-Bissau, in Mozambique. But those leaders were killed of those struggles, and perhaps the struggles were infiltrated, and also there were internal contradictions and problems that they had that in the end corrupted some of those movements. Whereas in South Africa, they did win and bring about an end to apartheid without a bloodbath, which was an astonishing accomplishment.
It was, absolutely.
And in Vietnam, they won and defended their country against United States shoving development down their throats on terms of the United States. And while now they still have to negotiate with the World Bank, at least they can do so with a government of their own choosing.
Mm-hmm.
But the personal, environmental, and economic cost that they had to endure for that war was astronomical and will last for generations.
Mm-hmm.
And so one has to ask, is there any war of self-defense in the future that could be worth it, that's fought like that? And I think given that, you know, shoulder-fired missiles are accessible to anyone on a street corner, anywhere in the world except the United States, pretty much. Given that level of accessibility to violence, I think we have to find better ways of confronting and of demanding and in contending for power, but without using those same weapons. Although there will still be instances, I think, when it has to be used in self-defense.
Mm-hmm.
But collective self-defense, I think, now is very risky. And as we learned, too often it becomes, and is as obvious in Africa now, it becomes a rampant opportunity sort of for male testosterone to run wild. And it happened with us in the 60s to some extent. It's happened in every armed struggle around the world unless people fought very hard against that, like the Vietnamese did. But it's very hard to do, and I think no longer worth the chance.
Kathy Wilkerson, we have run out of time. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you very much.
And I do recommend that people read your book, Flying Close to the Sun, My Life and Times as a Weatherman. It was a fascinating book. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. We are supported in part by the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes in Corning, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.